almost in reverence. His big white teeth bit into the crusty yet doughy bread. He savored the bracing crunchiness of onion, the saltiness of the salami, the thick brown tang of the mustard. He chewed and chewed, spilling crumbs everywhere, pausing now and then to pick them up with his greasy fingers, licking them between bites. And when he was finished, when his hands were dripping with oil and mustard littered with crumbs, his stomach temporarily silenced. He remembered that there would be food tonight at the party. Babe had promised him that, reminding him before he left for work in the morning, "Don't worry, darling. I'll take care of you. We'll have something more substantial than party food." And now he wasn't even hungry. Bill consulted his watch, picked up the phone on his desk, and called his driver. Then he went into his private dressing room, no mere executive bathroom, but a real dressing room with rows of extra suits and shirts and ties. Quickly, he shed one wrinkled shirt. He merely dropped it on the floor, never for a second wondering who might pick it up and have it laundered, for a fresh one, and put on a different suit jacket. Tied a new tie. He splashed some water on his face, combed his hair, cut closer than he used to wear it, to disguise the thinning, and then strode out of his office toward an elevator at the end of the hall. His secretary called out a sincere, "Good night, Mr. Paley." And before him, dozens of other secretaries and vice presidents and directors scraped and bowed, raising hats, wishing him the fondest of good nights. Bill didn't even notice them. He was thinking of the evening ahead and gritting his teeth until he realized, with a jolt, that despite the ordeal before him, he was looking forward to seeing Truman, even though he'd seen him last weekend and would see him this one coming up. And he hadn't had a friend like that in, well, had he ever? Someone whose company he truly enjoyed, who didn't bring with him any headaches, past or present, like Morrow now. Ed used to be the debonair bon vivant reminder of the glamorous war years when he and CBS were the voice of the war, of dashing correspondence, righteousness, bravery. Now Ed's very presence only reminded him of angry sponsors, and President Eisenhower calling him on the phone, asking him why one of his own employees, the face of CBS News no less, was so intent on being a pinko. So, where once he and Ed Murrow had dined at Claridge's while the bombs rained down on London, toasting to the triumph of good over evil and bedding grateful English girls, including Pam Churchill, that tasty little British dish. Now, he and Truman Capote hobnobbed in Manhattan. With Babe, of course. Bill had to forcibly remind himself of his wife's presence tonight. She would look beautiful, as always, tall and elegant and coolly perfect. An asset. Just as prized as the new Picasso he'd hung in the foyer of the St. Regis Pied-à-Terre. Just as valuable. Just as essential to his sense of self. Bill suddenly remembered the sandwich. Did he have any bits of salami stuck between his teeth? He peered at himself in the mirrored elevator wall, baring his teeth, as the uniformed elevator boy tactfully examined his polished black shoes. No. Nothing amiss. He looked good. And not just for his age, 57 this year. He was still tall, no sloped shoulders, still flat of stomach, although no one who saw how viciously he ate could ever understand how. He still had that grin, that devouring yet boyishly infectious grin. He looked good. Damn good. Maybe that friend of Truman's that he'd met at another one of these parties, that cute little Carol Marcus, would be there tonight. She was a blonde cream puff, a Marilyn look-alike, just his type. Bill grinned. thinking about pink, pert nipples against creamy, filmy silk, writhing hips beneath his hands, softness, suppleness, buoyant boobs slapping against his chest. And just like that, Bill Paley was hungry again.
"Bill, have you ever seen anything like this?"
Truman approached him, a martini in one hand, a cigarette in the other. He was red of face, flustered, sweat plastering his thinning hair to his forehead. But he surveyed the room with the satisfaction of a potentate.
"Oh, I love the Plaza, don't you? It's my favorite place on earth. I just adore how even the bellhops look down their noses at you, as if you might take a shit in the potted plants. How wonderful of Babe to throw me this little shindig."
"You deserve it. Even though I don't want to think about what this little shindig is costing me. What's the new book called again?"
Bill downed the last warm drops of watered-down bourbon and signaled for a fresh glass. One magically appeared.
"It's a novella. Breakfast at Tiffany's. Random House published it while I was in Europe, but what a nice treat to come home to. And Babe, of course. She simply insisted on throwing this little fet, even as I begged her not to."
Truman shook his head, but he did not appear to be too put out. This little fete was taking place in the Oak Room at the Plaza. For Mrs. William S. Paley and her friend, the best-selling author, Truman Capote, naturally management had closed it to the public on this night. The vaulted ceilings, the gleaming oak walls, the heavy square bar at the end of the room, the old baronial atmosphere of the place was lightened somewhat by cozy little round tables filled with flowers and copies of Truman's book, the red cover emblazoned with the words "Breakfast at Tiffany's, a short novel, and three other stories by Truman Capote." Bill could see a copy of it wherever he looked, for Babe had bought out Brentano's. Bennett and Phyllis Cerf, holding court at the other end of the room, must be counting the profits even while they were making small talk. But Bennett was only the publisher. Truman was the writer. And Bill respected artists, creative types. He was like Bennett himself, arbiter and procurer of talent, so he had no great awe for the founder of Random House, and besides, there was no money in books anyway. Television was where it was at. But around someone like Truman, especially tonight, Bill could sometimes be uncharacteristically shy. For Bill Paley truly admired artists, and he had to admit that Truman, swishy and flamboyant, was a complete professional at his craft, taking it very seriously, secreting himself away from even Babe for long periods of time to work on it. And he was good, talented, respected by those who should know, his peers and critics. And so Bill had to respect him too, and sometimes, just like when Jack Benny and George Burns bent their heads together and dissected a joke with the cold precision of surgeons, Bill got a little tongue-tied. He hadn't read this book, mind you, and Truman didn't appear to have expected him to. Another thing Bill appreciated about him: Truman simply seemed happy to see his friend, to involve him in his celebration. Before he joined Bill at the bar, Truman had been swanning about, gliding through the other guests, accepting accolades with humility, poking and provoking. "So what did you think of Holly? The only completely honest character I've ever written, hand to God." Or wagging his finger at Slim, at Gloria, at CZ, at Marella, and that dishy little Carol and her equally dishy friend, Gloria Vanderbilt.
"Now you don't think I modeled Holly after you, do you? She's my own creation."
But now, with Bill, he seemed to relax, shrug off the famous author mantle, and appeared happy to talk about anything other than himself.
"Babe said you were about to buy another Degas. I'd love to see it."
"Yeah, yeah. My broker has a lead. I don't know where I'll hang it yet, though. That's always the thing, isn't it?
Problems, problems,
Truman said with an impish grin, and Bill had to laugh at himself and take a swig of ice-cold bourbon on the rocks.
Christ, I know that sounds so pompous. I would have given my left nut to have these kinds of problems back in the day.
Don't I know it?
Truman narrowed his eyes, looking out at the party. The two men were leaning against the great oak bar. From across the room, Babe, tall and impossibly beautiful in a red-wool Charles James cocktail suit with a portrait collar, stood out even among this rarefied crowd of millionaires and models, actors and authors.
Now, you see, I have to think about what I'll write next. What can possibly trump this last book? It's always on my mind. Do I keep writing short stories, journalism? What about another novel? I just don't seem to have the stamina for a novel, though, but it does seem as if it's expected of me. I have ideas, of course. I record them all. But I don't know, honey, I just don't. And there's so much pressure, you have no idea. Bennett may smile and say, take your time, but he runs a business and I make money for that business, and so I'm a bit like a sharecropper, indebted to the company store.
But your talent...
Now Bill felt more comfortable. He was on familiar ground here.
Talent has to be made some allowances. I couldn't let Jack Benny work 52 weeks a year. He needs a hiatus. And when he's off the air, or we're in reruns, I lose money, believe me, but he needs the time off to recharge. The show would suffer.
What about that Lucy show? Truman arched an eyebrow and rubbed his forehead with his pinky finger. I wouldn't call that quality television, Bill.
No, you're right, it's not. And she's showing some age. The show, that is.
Lucy, too.
And Truman sat his drink down, put both hands to the side of his face, and pulled the skin back. Tight.
Bill laughed again. But people, pardon the pun, love Lucy. Shows like that make money. They allow me to put on other things, more highbrow. Leonard Bernstein's concerts, for example. Playhouse 90.
What's your favorite show, Bill? Tell me, I'm curious. I know a patriarch isn't supposed to have favorites, but you must. And don't just blurt out the show that makes the most money.
Gunsmoke.
Bill replied without a moment's hesitation. Oh, my God! And Truman threw back his head and laughed. He clapped his hands as delighted as a boy at the circus. But Bill wasn't at all embarrassed by the reaction. He was accustomed to it.
Gunsmoke is America. It's good versus evil. It's like it used to be. Like it used to be in the war.
But he did surprise himself by this comparison. He hadn't thought about it that way before. But by God, that was it.
Probably.
Why he loved the show so damn much. The simple heroism of Marshall Dillon, Ed Murrow during the war, but in a 10-gallon hat instead of a trench coat. The comic relief of Chester, the gruff wisdom of Doc, the too-good-to-be-true whore with the heart of gold, Miss Kitty. And evil. Every episode in the form of outlaws and bandits and speculators and Indians. Uncomplicated evil. Bad guys who needed their comeuppance, and thanks to him, Bill Paley, by way of Marshal Matt Dillon, played by James Arness, the sweetest, dumbest lug he'd ever met. They would get it. They'd get that bullet in the heart, or a scalping by the Indians, or be run out of town forever, because they deserved it. Just like Hitler. Just like the Nazis. Just like the Japs. Today, the enemy wasn't so clear. Sometimes Bill was just so heartily sick of all he had to contend with, instilling loyalty oaths. A few years back, God, Ed Murrow had given him an earful about that. There were commies, pinkos, those Rosenbergs, giving him one more reason to try to forget he was a Jew. There were always problems with affiliates, griping about the programming,
There were always sponsors threatening to withdraw, like Alcoa, pulling out of See It Now.
Color television?
Well, he'd lost that battle.
David Sarnoff and RCA won. It was their technology, not CBS's, that the government determined to be the industry standard.
I like the show, Truman, that's all. It appeals to me, for reasons I'm sure you'll never understand.
But Truman surprised him. Truman always managed to surprise him. Bill, I'm the last person on this earth who would criticize your taste. I believe that the most creative, forward-thinking personalities are those with a healthy dose of lowbrow mixed with highbrow. That's your genius. As it is mine, I'm not too modest to say. Modesty bores me. I hate people who act coy. Just come right out and say it if you believe it. I'm the greatest. I'm the cat's pajamas. I'm it.
And Truman clinked his own glass, a martini, against Bill's.
So are you, Bill Paley. You are it. We both are. Two titans astride their world.
Bill grinned and relaxed. He had to hand it to Truman. He was the only fairy in New York who knew how to talk to men, real men.
Oh, Truman, you naughty, naughty boy.
A dishy blonde, not that Carol, but someone who looked a lot like her, wriggled up to them. She was wearing a very low-cut, very tight, red satin dress. Immediately, Bill thought that if Babe saw her, she'd wrinkle her nose and decide the fabric was too shiny, the cut too extreme, the overall effect cheap. Sometimes he couldn't help but see women through his wife's superior eyes, but it never clouded his overall vision.
What, Mona?
Truman gazed at the girl with a calm, bemused expression.
You know she's me. Ha, I mean, I. Polly go lightly, I'm her. I know you based her on me.
Mona, my dearest, most vapid girl, I assure you that I did not. Holly-go-lightly is entirely my own creation.
Oh, no.
The girl inched closer and looked up at Bill. Her eyes widened, and she squirmed as if someone had just dropped an ice cube down her back.
Now I want you to tell this gorgeous man here. Bill Paley, Mona Cartwright. Mona Cartwright, Bill Paley. Oh, so nice to meet you, Mr. Paley. Anyway, true, I want you to tell Mr. Paley that I am the model for Holly Go Lightly, the things I've told you over too many cocktails, and then I read them on the pages of your story. The South American, that Brazilian, you know I told you all about that. Mona, you may believe what you like. If it helps you sleep at night, by all means, go to bed thinking you're Holly Go Lightly. Now be a good little Marilyn and wriggle off somewhere else.
Truman. Mona leaned over to kiss Truman on the cheek and flash Bill her creamy, heaving cleavage. Then she did sashay off with only one sleepy-lidded backward glance.
Honestly.
Truman turned to Bill with a chuckle. Even a less keen observer of the human condition than Truman Capote couldn't have helped to notice the hunger, the desire, in Bill Paley's eyes as they followed the blonde through her maneuvers. Truman noted, but made no reference to it. He simply stored it away. For now.
Everyone wants to be in a book, he drawled exaggeratedly. I've simply been deluged by women who believe they're the model for Holly. Carol Marcus, Gloria Vanderbilt, Gloria Guinness, Marilla, Slim even. They all think that some part of Holly is based on them.
I don't want to be in a book,
Bill said with a grunt.
I have no desire. I think it would be terrible, actually, to have people read something and think it's about you.
Well, you're an exception, then.
An exception to what? Babe had suddenly inserted herself between her husband and her friend.
With one arm behind Bill's back and the other tucked into Truman's arm, she surveyed her party with a beatific, satisfied smile. An exception to mere mortals. Bill, that is. He claims he'd hate to be written about in a book. Oh, Bill. Babe tilted her impeccable head up to him and laughed. She was exceptionally beautiful tonight. She seemed to have her own spotlight following her around, illuminating her features, making her eyes even darker, her cheekbones even more pronounced, her hair even silkier. Just to look at her, Bill smiled, the satisfied grin of ownership. Truman, the incredulous grin of appreciation. Their gazes met behind Babe's back. Bill's eyes widened, as did Truman's. So they had something else in common, too. But I think he's right. Babe continued, unaware of the slight jousting occurring on either side. Bill's arm encircled her waist. Truman gripped her arm more tightly. I would detest being in a book. Promise me that, Truman. Promise me you won't ever do that. I know every woman here tonight thinks she's Holly-go-lightly, but I... And she shuddered. I don't know how I could, Truman said, and he knew it to be honest and true, as honest and true as Holly-go-lightly herself. Any words of mine could never do you justice, Babe, dear. Babe blushed. A rarity. Bill could count on one hand the number of times he'd seen his wife blush, and each one was because of Truman. With Bill, she was so composed, always, composed and dignified, and untouchable, impervious to abandonment or real emotion. But that little blonde. Now there was a woman who a man, a real man like Bill Paley, not some little homo like Truman Capote, could make blush. Pretty pink. From her cheeks to her little round... Bill, dear, I know you must be famished. They'll bring in a buffet in a moment, full of your favorites. I made sure of it. I also reserved a table for you and for Jock and Betsy, so you don't have to talk to anyone you don't want to.
Never mind. I'm not hungry. And I think I'll disappear now, Babe. I had a hard day.
Bill, his eyes following that little blonde as she sashayed her way around the room, did not even glance at his wife's face.
Truman, will you see Babe home? I give her to you, for now. And congratulations again. I'm sure it's a terrific book, and Babe will make me read it someday.
Truman laughed and grasped Bill's hand in his own surprisingly strong grip. Babe, after an imperceptible intake of breath, kissed her husband on the cheek and whispered sincerely, a worried expression in her brown eyes. You go home and go right to bed, poor darling. I'll sleep in the drawing room when I come in so I won't disturb you. Then she watched her husband stride through the room, his arms swinging in that commanding way of his grin as he was greeted by everyone in his path, incandescent enough to light the room all by itself. Truman turned Babe around, toward the bartender, just in time. Just in time for her not to see Bill Paley follow a writhing, red satin-clad bottom out of the oak room of the plaza.
Now the fun will really start,
he whispered in her ear, delighted to see her wary eyes turn girlish, just at the promise of his voice.
Now we'll have the best time ever, just the two of us.
And Babe, hastily erasing the frown that had puckered her forehead, put her hand in Truman's, trusting him. Bill didn't give either of them another thought. He was too busy convincing the little blonde to go upstairs, allowing her maidenly protests, playing the game as well as any other man in his position, with his wealth, his appetites, his power. It didn't take very long. It never did.
Chapter 9. Babe was up before Bill the next morning, as usual. After a short but heavenly night's sleep on the drawing room sofa, she'd been able to take her teeth out, thank the Lord. She'd risen with the sun, determined to call her florist's private number and arrange a special early delivery. Then she'd rushed into the bathroom, made up her face, and rung for some coffee. Delivered to her, naturally, by St. Regis room service, the waiter pushing in a mahogany cart with her own Wedgwood coffee pot and cup and saucer, and a silver vase with a peony in it, not a rose. As soon as she and Bill redecorated this small apartment and made it their city residence, she'd gone down to the kitchen and introduced herself to all the staff, thanking them in advance for their care and consideration, and asking them, if they pleased, never to put a rose on her tray. They understood, surely, that she and Bill wanted to think of this as a real home, not a hotel, and she so looked forward to doing just that with their help. And, of course, she asked her secretary to record all their birthdays, and she never missed a one, sending a card with a little extra gift of money to each. She and Bill were both generous tippers, each week sending out little envelopes full of cash to those who made their lives easier. When she was out shopping, she often brought something back, something small, like a flattering lipstick or a silk flower pin or a cigarette case, for a maid or a particularly attentive bellman. Thus, the peony and her own china, not the official St. Regis pattern, and the newspapers ironed, without her even having to ask. "Thank you so much," she told the waiter, a new boy with a complexion like a lobster, so skinny his Adam's apple was as pronounced as his nose. "Andrew, isn't it? I so appreciate it." And Andrew, Andy to his friends and family, but not here, not at the St. Regis where nicknames were not allowed, blushed, his face turning even more mottled and scarlet. He tripped over his own comically large feet on the way out, and thought to himself as he took the service elevator back down to the kitchen that he'd never seen a more beautiful gal than Mrs. Paley first thing in the morning. He thought of his own mother, probably just getting up in their apartment in Queens, in her scruffy old quilted housecoat, her hair still in curlers, no makeup on, her eyes puffy from sleep, creases on her face as if she'd slept on chicken wire instead of a lumpy mattress, drinking her coffee out of a heavy mug while she watched the small TV in the kitchen, picking away at the chipped formica on the table. But Mrs. Paley, she looked as if she didn't need sleep at all. She was wearing some kind of silk gown with a tie around her waist, and slippers that looked like real shoes, only with little puffs of fur on the end, and her hair was all done. And he thought, although he wasn't sure, because he never could tell about these things, just ask his girlfriend Sue, that she even had lipstick on, and her eyes weren't the least bit red and puffy. Not at all. Not a crease of sleep on her face, either. Babe smiled after Andrew the waiter left. She'd read the awe, the appreciation on his face. And even if he was just a young man, a waiter, she enjoyed that, of course. What woman doesn't enjoy being appreciated? To know that, first thing in the morning, was very special indeed. And she savored the moment, lighting a cigarette, inhaling through her ebony holder, watching the closed door through the haze of smoke, half wondering if Andrew would pop back in for another glimpse, on the pretext of forgetting something. But then she shook her head sternly. "Oh, babe, stop being such a common girl." And she poured her coffee and dialed the phone. 3 hours later, after Bill had risen, showered, shaved, shoveled his food down his throat, kissed her cheek, and left for work with a grunt, there was a knock at the door, and Babe ran to answer it, her heart beating wildly. What was wrong with her today? She really was acting like a teenager. How did you know? Truman had tears in his swollen red eyes as he held out his hand. In it was a small vase of lilies of the valley, their sweet, bell-like flowers still creamy white against the dark green foliage. How on earth did you know? I just did. Truman fell into Babe's arms. She grabbed the vase from him just in time. They walked into the drawing room, Truman's head on her shoulder, tears streaming down his face. I am so blue, he sobbed quietly as they sat down on a small sofa. Just so blue. And you knew. You knew. Yes, I knew you would be the morning after. I had a feeling. It's so hard. Why does it always have to be so hard? Truman's shoulders shook with a suppressed sob. And Jack doesn't understand at all. He's so tyrannical in his way. He has absolutely no sympathy for me. He just doesn't know how empty I am, even after last night, especially after last night and nights like it. How the hollowness just gets to you. The loneliness. The special loneliness of being in a room full of people who are there just for you. God, he has no idea. I do, Babe whispered into her friend's ear. I do, dearest Truman. Because Bill, oh, I was so furious with him last night. He didn't even see me, did he? Not once did he compliment me. I had that suit made especially for him, because he once said he liked that color. And he didn't even eat a bite of all that food I arranged just for him. He didn't say a word to Betsy and Jock. He has no idea how hard I work to make things just right for him, to give him what he wants, and to look how he wants me to... He just takes it all for granted. Why, even the waiter this morning who brought up my coffee took more notice of me. And that's why I brought you some of my flowers. Truman pointed to the vase that Babe had set down on an end table. Not just an end table, of course, but a priceless Louis XVI commode. You sent me these flowers because you knew I'd be blue. I brought you some because I knew the same thing. We don't even have to tell each other, do we, Babe? We just know. It's so rare, what we have. Come here, my darling girl. And he held out his arms. Babe stretched out on the sofa. Not just a sofa, naturally, but a Louis XVI settee completely recovered in an antique silk upholstery, recreated and woven just for the Paleys. And put her head on Truman's lap. He smoothed that throbbing vein on her forehead, pale blue against her creamy skin. She closed her eyes and let a few tears fall. I hate him sometimes, you know. I really do. I don't know what time he came home last night. I didn't check to see if he was in bed when I got home. I don't do that anymore. I just... don't want to know. But you love him, too, Truman whispered soothingly. Just like I love Jack. We hate them, but we can't live without them. Jack loves you back. Bill doesn't love me. Jack is prickly and fierce to everyone because he wants to protect you, because he values you. Bill wouldn't throw me a life preserver if I was drowning. That's ridiculous. He loves you, Babe. He just doesn't know how to show it. Not like I do. And you love him, too. Admit it. I want him to love me. Is that the same thing? Babe's eyes remained closed. She thought back to when she first met Bill, after having been told through mutual friends that he admired her. Babe was newly divorced from a Tuxedo Park blue blood, who had hit her on occasion. But that was what makeup was for, Goggs had sternly reminded her when Babe came running home for comfort. Funny, though, how vehemently her mother argued for divorce after the blue blood revealed all his money was tied up in trust. She was, she recalled, emotionally bruised and battered, feeling as if she'd been found wanting in judgment and taste. Even though she had absolutely no memory of ever choosing Stanley Mortimer, only of being forced to sit next to him at debutante party after party, dinner after dinner, until she found herself sitting beside him in a bridal gown at their wedding lunch. Despite her emotional fragility, Babe Cushing Mortimer had been at the peak of her desirability. Beautiful, more sure of her taste and fashion sense than ever before, still ripe, and with no money to speak of but a fabulous lifestyle to finance. Because what else could a woman like her, of good breeding, a finishing school education, and coveted looks, do but live well and decoratively? And that took money, of course. And Bill, not quite divorced. Although later they both conveniently rearranged the timeline and insisted that he had already jettisoned the first wife. But Bill, that evening she first saw him at one of Condé Nast's hilariously crowded parties, was certainly the most vibrant man in the room, with that blustery grin. Stanley, her first husband, had so rarely smiled. The grinning, brash young head of CBS was also by far the most important man present. Even more important than the host. This was evident by the way all the guests circled about him, eager and obsequious, while Condé sat alone in a corner, munching on canapes. And then Bill raised his head above the sycophants and saw her, Babe, standing tall beneath a chandelier, a silver fox stole over her shoulders. And he chose her. She saw it in his eyes, the way they widened, the way his shoulders squared, his head snapped up. And there was nothing more she wanted but to be possessed by him. Reassured of her worth in a world where feminine beauty and refinement were currency. Someone whispered that he was Jewish. But in that heady moment of being acquired by someone as powerful and handsome and wealthy as he was, it didn't matter. Or, perhaps it did. Her mother had picked out Stanley Mortimer. Goggs would never have picked out Bill Paley. That was Babe's decision alone. Perhaps the first she'd made in her life. But was that love? She hurt when Bill hurt. That was true. Once, she'd walked over to a new swim club being built across the road from Kailuna North in Lily White, New Hampshire. She thought the children could join. It would do them good to make friends. She introduced herself as Mrs. William S. Paley, filled out the forms, was polite and sincere in her hope that the Paleys could enjoy the club. But she never heard back. Later, a neighbor told her it was because Bill and his children were Jewish, but that she, Babe, could join if she liked. She'd never told Bill this. She had seen him so wounded, so forlorn when similar rejections had occurred. His blue eyes would fill with tears, and his chin would tremble as if he were a little boy and not one of the most powerful men in all of broadcasting. Then the hurt would drain away to wrath, to steely determination. Another house, or another Picasso, or another television station, or another designer dress that Babe didn't really want but that Bill insisted on. Insisted on her looking so unattainable that those who rejected him would surely gnash their teeth in despair to look at what he owned. Whom he owned. Whom he married, that is. But love? She'd never felt her heart race in anticipation, knowing she would see Bill. Yet every time she was going to meet Truman, she felt so excited, so certain of delight that her skin tingled with adrenaline, and she found herself laughing, all alone, even before he arrived. She always looked her best for Bill, but she went out of her way to find some new twist or flair to delight Truman. Bells on her skirt, a whimsical brooch on an otherwise tasteful, expensive blouse. Because to make Truman gasp, to make him clap his hands, dance with joy, be struck dumb with awe, was simply the greatest delight she knew. Pleasure, she realized. Joy, anticipation. None of these had anything to do with how she felt about her husband, or even her children. But they had everything to do with how she felt about Truman. Do you know what? Babe sat up, reached into her pocket, and dried her eyes with an embroidered handkerchief, careful not to smudge her mascara. She gazed at Truman, who was holding her hand tenderly, caressing it, loving it, claiming her. So Babe took a deep breath and decided to take the plunge. To be loved was not something she ever expected for herself, not anymore. But to love someone? Oh, yes. Oh, God, yes. No one could deprive her of that. My analyst said something ridiculous to me the other day. She couldn't prevent a nervous laugh. She couldn't look Truman in the eye. He said, I can't believe he said this. He said, I ought to have an affair with you. That you were obviously my obsession, and an affair would be a good thing, a healthy thing. For me, that is. Babe felt unsteady, even though she was seated on the sofa. The room, red fabric walls, the silk hangings on the window, the most charming antiques money could buy seemed to press in on her, tighter than the most unforgiving ball gown, the most constricting undergarment. Nothing was as it was supposed to be. The room was no longer a diorama of money and taste, arranged by the best decorators in town, Billy Baldwin and Sister Parrish. But rather, now it was a circus tent. A hideous circus tent. Oh, why hadn't she seen this before? All that fabric on the ceiling and the walls. And she was the freak show on display. All her needs and wants spilling out of her, pooling into the sawdust at her feet. She couldn't breathe, although she was aware acutely of the sound of Truman doing just that, sitting next to her. Suddenly she pulled her hand away from his and buried her face in a pillow. She simply couldn't bear to hear what she knew he was going to say. Oh, babe. And his voice was soft, sad. Oh, my babe. Do you know, do you have any idea how dearly I would love for that to be possible? Babe shook her head, the silk tassels of the pillow tickling her cheek. If she could only stay buried, if she never had to look at Truman's face. But that was impossible. She felt his hands, strong and masculine and soft and feminine, pulling her up, turning her toward him. He pushed her hair out of her eyes, and finally she had to look. His face was naked, completely vulnerable. He'd taken off his glasses, an act of intimacy that made her heart race with hope. He leaned into her, carefully, and holding his breath, just like the most tender, most unsure of hopeful lovers. He kissed her, his lips tickling hers. But then he pulled away, although he kept his hands on her shoulders, There were tears in his beautiful eyes. But it's not possible. I am who I am, and I'm not ashamed of it. I like men. I always have. I've never even been tempted by the thought of being with a woman. But now, this moment is the first time in my entire life when I have wished, just for the teensiest bit, that I was. You must know that, and remember it. We must remember this moment forever, because it is love we feel for each other. And we're so lucky to have it. Babe took a deep breath, let the air fill her lungs almost to bursting, holding it in like a child desperate for a wish to come true. If it had been anyone else but Truman, she would have run, hidden herself. If it had been anyone else but Truman, she wouldn't have said this in the first place. Would never have exposed herself so thoroughly, allowed herself to be seen as someone real with raw needs and desires. If it had been anyone else but Truman, whom she did love, just as he said. She released her breath. If it had been anyone else but Truman. But it was Truman, wasn't it? Now and always. He was still the same soul who saw her and appreciated her, no matter how she allowed herself to be seen, vulnerable or impenetrable, exquisitely clothed and coiffed or with her hair unkempt, her eyes pink and runny. It was Truman. It's ridiculous, I know. I told Dr. Cameron so. It's just that... And Babe suddenly found herself with her friend again, not rejected at all, and best of all, most startling of all, loved, even if it wasn't quite the way she longed to be. But sometimes one had to make the best of things. Hadn't her mother taught her that all her life? Bill might not see her, might not love her, but Truman, in his way, did. So Babe indulged herself, pouring out that swollen sack of loneliness and regret, spilling it all over his lap, knowing he wouldn't mind the mess of it after all. It's just that I do get lonely, you know? For love, in that way. Bill won't be that for me again, if he ever was. Oh, but I do miss it. I long for it. I long to be touched and desired. I don't know how I can live the rest of my life, knowing that my husband doesn't want me. And I've never told anyone that before. Not even Dr. Cameron, not even my sisters. I don't know why I told you, even. But I'm glad. I'm so glad that I did. Babe closed her eyes and laid her head back down in Truman's lap. He didn't say a word for a very long time. He only continued to stroke her hair, bend down to kiss her on the lips, chastely but lovingly. She could have gone to sleep. She could have slept better than she ever had. No need for a Milltown. She felt sated, physically, as if they had indeed consummated their passion. And perhaps they had. After several minutes, she opened her eyes. Truman was gazing down at her with such love, such sincere concern. She smiled and sat up. Goodness, I must be a mess. Let me fix myself up and let's go out. What would you like to do? You look absolutely breathtaking. But do what you have to do, my love. I'd like to see a movie. Let's do that. Do you want me to ring up CBS and reserve the screening room? Or we could have them send something out to Kailuna and watch it there, in the little theater. Babe. Oh, my babe. Truman laughed, but it wasn't cruel.
Don't you ever go out to the movies? Like real people? To an actual theater?
Well, no. Not since... Well, not in a long time. Babe blushed. Sometimes she did forget how rarefied her life had become. Bless Truman for not making her feel utterly ridiculous.
Well, I meant we should go see a movie in a movie theater with popcorn and everything, not caviar, and it will be my treat.
Of course. That sounds wonderful. And Babe rose, herself once more. She felt her spine straighten, her breathing slow down, and the room once more was a gorgeous thing to behold. A testament to her taste and breeding and wealth. Bill's wealth. She was Barbara Cushing Mortimer Paley. And right now, this moment, maybe, perhaps, she was loved. Babe quickly changed into a Dior day dress, white silk with soft blue polka dots tight at the waist, with a bow to the side and a portrait collar. She supposed that was appropriate for a movie theater. Reapplied her makeup and selected a deeper blue Hermes bag. She put her gloves on, surveyed herself in the full-length mirror, turning around, craning her neck so she could see over her shoulder. One slight adjustment to her stocking, and she felt ready to sail out and face whoever might be looking her way. Maids, waiters, salespeople, photographers, Gloria or Slim or Morella or CZ. People, friends, family, strangers, looked at her. And they looked for her. They always had. It was a fact of her life. She must be ready, then. She must make it worth their while. Before we see the movie, I have a surprise for you. Babe rejoined Truman in the drawing room. He had reverted back to being rather melancholy. He had not moved from the sofa to fix himself a drink, or to ooh and ah at the paintings or antiques. He hadn't followed her into the bedroom to sit and gossip while she got ready. So unlike him. No. He was still seated on the sofa, his spectacles off, his face in his hands. When he looked up at her, she could see he had been rubbing his eyes, as they looked small and tired.
A surprise!
Now he did put on his glasses. She saw an interested little gleam in his eyes, and she was thrilled to have sparked it. A surprise!
Where are we going?
You'll see. And soon enough, they were sailing through the marble lobby of the St. Regis. With its clouds and cherubs on the ceiling, inlaid floors, gigantic floral arrangements, and crossing 55th Street, turning right on 5th Avenue and entering Tiffany's. The top-hatted doorman's eyes widened in recognition. He held the door open for them with a properly awed,
"Good morning, Mrs. Paley. Mr. Capote, what an honor."
Truman's face was truly gleaming now. He seemed to grow 5 inches.
"Oh, I do love Tiffany's,"
he sighed as he followed Babe's lead. She strode surely down the center aisle, not stopping to look in any of the cases, for naturally, Mrs. William S. Paley did not shop like mere mortals. There were private rooms and corridors for her, employees whom the regular shoppers would never see. Hidden doors, soft chairs, teacups, and jewels brought out on velvet trays just for her. Truman had never known this world until he met her. "Oh, Truman, one never buys jewelry in public. It's so dear of you, though, to think of it," she once told him, when he wanted to pop into Van Cleef to buy her a trinket. And far from being offended, he was grateful for the advice. He told her that she was the best finishing school in the world. And she'd beamed.
"Tiffany's is like a country club for the gods,"
Truman said with a sigh.
I always think that when I'm here.
And Babe smiled. The wooden paneling always did remind her of a club. A rarefied, exclusive club. Third floor, she instructed the elevator man, who nodded and pressed the button. I told you, Truman dear, that I'd been asked to design a little display upstairs.
No, you didn't, Bobolink. How thrilling.
Not really, Babe said with a wry smile. They asked several society ladies, as I believe they refer to us. Gloria did one, and so did Morella. The elevator opened, and they stepped out. In the display cases were exquisite place settings of china and crystal and silver, all tastefully illuminated. There was a room off to one side, where a young woman, clad in a dress, hat, and gloves that made her look 40, not 20, already dressing for the role, Babe decided, sat with her mother, obviously registering for wedding gifts. Babe slowed down and took Truman's hand in hers. She was already smiling, anticipating his reaction, when she led him into another room and pointed to the display. There, amid several boring, uninventive set pieces, Morella had set a wicker table with a china pattern of yellow roses and grapevines.
How typically revoltingly Italian, Truman whispered, while Babe shook her head in astonishment.
Gloria Guinness's table setting was equally uninspired.
La Guinness can't disguise the peasant in her, was Truman's pronouncement, even as Babe tried to shush him,
was a flowered chaise longue that Truman recognized from Babe's bedroom at Kailuna. Next to the chaise stood a round table holding a full place setting of bone china with a lattice-worked border, along with a silver coffee pot and a crystal glass filled with orange juice. On the chaise longue, half opened, was a copy of Truman's book.
"Breakfast at Tiffany's," he squealed, his face pure joy.
He laughed so delightedly from his belly that the smattering of hushed, earnest shoppers all turned his way. But Babe didn't care. She had done it. She had surprised him, delighted him, given him something back, given him back himself. The assured, triumphant self that had fled him the morning after, leaving him hollow and empty and so sad.
Oh, Babe, you dear, you love, you perfect creature. I'm utterly delighted, tickled to death, spank my bottom and call me Daddy.
I'm so glad you like it, Babe said, her face flushing with accomplishment. She couldn't help but think of how much time she'd put into this silly little thing, as she'd pronounced it to one and all, how she'd racked and racked her brain to come up with something different from the expected, and how pleased she'd been when she'd hit on the idea. She'd longed for weeks to tell Truman about it, but now was satisfied that she'd waited until just the right moment to share it with him. Now, let's go see that movie, she said. And he nodded as they left, pausing only to sign one or two autographs from patrons who had finally recognized him. With each signature, his eyes sparkled just a bit more. So did Babe's. The movie Truman chose was Pinocchio, that old Disney cartoon. She was mystified as to why he dragged her downtown, somewhere around the Bowery, and insisted on hailing a cab instead of phoning for a car. Babe pretended to enjoy riding in the big yellow taxi, making sure that a game, "Let's see what happens next" expression was arranged on her face. But she was fearful the entire ride that she'd sat in something dreadful like gum or a squished candy bar, or worse. The theater was in what she would euphemistically call an interesting neighborhood. There were many young Negro children playing in the street all by themselves, no parents or nannies in watchful attendance. Rusty cars and delivery trucks